My name is Penny Lacaso and I am the world's first happiness hacker. Imagine a world where human happiness and well-being drove our decision-making. A world where technology was used to amplify human potential rather than replace it. The Human First podcast is designed to encourage you to explore your curiosity about the future of humanity. Our conversations are focused on building skill in intentional adaptability, creating the foundation to positively influence the future for yourself, but also for others. Join me here each week as we put humans first.
I'm sitting here today with Dom Price, who's someone that I'm embarrassed to say I've been stalking on LinkedIn for
a while now.
That's
perfectly fine.
So this is a bit of an honour for me. So basically, Dom is a work futurist,
yes,
and also the head of R&D at Atlassian.
Yeah, I like two jobs.
Yeah. So tell us, what does success look like in this job for you?
Oh, that's a good question. Success is kind of a little bit profound. So success is saying the world around us is changing at an epic rate.
Yeah.
And if we end up in a position of status quo, we are actually going backwards. And so instead of just embracing chaos, which a lot of people think is cool, it's not chaos, it's bad. It's how can we take the unpredictability and ambiguity of the world around us and use it for good and not for evil.
Mm.
So half my job, the head of R&D part, is saying, how do we understand how work gets done? And how do we evolve that? And how do we change our practices? So nothing to do with technology, which for a technology company is a bit weird. We're a company that buys and sells tools. It's all about practices and human behavior. How do we evolve the way we work? And then as we get good at that internally, the other part of my role, the work futurist role, is how do we share that story? Because when we put that story out into the world, people respond. And that response enables us to evolve our products and our ways of working. So it's a continuous loop. The more we go and tell the story, the more we hear. It stops us being insular. The more we hear, the more we then evolve our way of working, stops us being stagnant.
And people, I mean, I don't know, but people are desperate for the how at the moment. Mm. It's like so many businesses and individuals are lost. And it's like, when I say lost, it's like, tell us how, because it's so overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know the tactical stuff that we can do to start to shift things now. Yeah. So can you give us some examples of how you're taking that sort of macro insight and turning it into tactical ways that companies and individuals can start to shift to adapt for the future?
Okay, so a good example is collaboration, right? The buzzword of the moment. So if you think about collaboration as a skill, it's been happening since caveman. Cavemen would draw on a wall, aboriginals drew on rocks. Like collaboration and storytelling has existed for as long as humans have been on the earth. The problem is, in the last 15, 20 years, we gave the power to the CIO. And the CIO decided that they'd buy tools. And they bought tools and they were like, look, here's a piece of collaboration software. Now I want you to auto-collaborate.
Yeah.
They expected this silver bullet to just magically create collaboration. And the problem is collaboration is tools and people and practices together. But we over-indexed in the last 15 years on tools. We have bought tools to solve problems that are human problems. Collaboration is a human problem, not a technological problem.
It's so interesting, right? Because I've worked in change in Shell for years before I did what I do now. And so as an expert in change, I think it's so interesting because we're still not good at change.
No.
And large companies are not great at change.
No.
And I think so much of this is because change is imposed rather than engaged, yeah? It's driven by productivity efficiencies rather than get people engaged in it before they, you know, create the idea of change. It's like, hey, we've got a great idea. We've bought a tool. Mm. Let's now impose the change.
Answer.
And, you know, one of the most important elements of a change process is the end, which is reinforcement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that shift in behavior so that people actually adopt it.
Yeah, the habits.
Yeah.
So we talk about habits and rituals. Now, the interesting thing is when I think about change, I think one of the challenges there is people, again, over-index on change being the problem. I think the root cause of the problem is short-termism. If you think about businesses that struggle, it's the ones that are trying to be efficient in the short term.
Yes.
And so they're the ones doing optimization today, and they'll be the ones doing transformation tomorrow when they get caught with the trousers down, right? And so what happens is you're like, well, I just got to get through this quarter, and then I'll do the revolutionary thing next year.
Yeah.
Or I've just got to get through this half or this year. And so what happens?
It's avoiding pain, isn't it?
But you end up taking these really short-term decisions. Mm. And when you do that, you become efficient. The problem is businesses that are successful in this modern era are the ones that are effective, that stay relevant. And to stay relevant, you have to change. So if you look at Blockbusters in the year 2000, 13,000 video stores in North America, and they made $800 million that year from late fees. They had no need to change in their minds. $800 million just from people hiring Armageddon and returning it a day late. That same year, they had the chance to buy Netflix for $50
million. Oh, that's going to hurt.
But because so if you look at the Fortune 500 from the year 2000, 50% of them are no longer there. So they were very efficient, large, monolithic businesses. They didn't stay relevant. So relevance is about understanding the market you're in and moving into that market. Whether it be something that you're good at or not, you have to go and learn it.
Yeah.
Whereas most businesses get so short term, they're there to make profit or to deliver a number. And if you do that, you'll do what you did yesterday. You'll just try and do it faster or harder. Relevance says, actually, what I did yesterday might not work. What can I do tomorrow that's different? It's a very different mindset.
So talk to us a little bit about the macro trends in tech and AI that have got you excited at the moment.
Absolutely none of them. Deadly.
I wasn't expecting that. Yeah.
Deadly. So I think there's some fascinating things. The things that are actually more fascinating for me right now, how we manage and lead a multi-generational workforce.
Mm.
So millennials are going to make up the majority of the workforce. As a leader in today's business, I'm managing more generations than any leader before me. And I don't know that I've got the skills or aptitude or competence to do that because those generations are vastly different.
Yeah.
The 60, 65-year-old baby boomer has lived a very different life and has a different set of accumulated experiences than the 21-year-old graduate. Now, they're all fully formed adults. They're all really smart people.
Yeah.
And they can all have the growth mindset, but they've just lived and seen a very different world, you know, digital native to digital immigrant. And so millennials fascinate me, or it's like multi-generational workforce. The other one, which is probably the most profound thing that I don't think we've understood, is mental health.
Oh.
As AI and robotics and automation take away all the mundane tasks, I will be left with hard, complex tasks only. Now, I would love to think that Atlassian is a wonderful employer, will say, Dom, I'm going to pay you the same salary to do 20 hours complex work.
Yeah.
It's unlikely to happen. So they're going to get me to do 40 hours complex work. Whereas today, I maybe do 20 hours complex, 20 hours simple. So when I'm doing 40 hours of complex work, back in the day, if me and you worked in a factory, we'd get calluses on our hands because we worked too hard.
Mm.
But who can see the calluses on our brain?
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, I think that, I don't know what you're observing, but I know in the work that I'm doing with large corporations, the level of overwhelm and anxiety, I think is at the highest level it's ever been as a society.
Mm.
And one of the biggest concerns that I have about what's happening, as much as I love the tech and AI space, is that we are just compounding change time and time again, and the level of uncertainty.
Yes.
And there doesn't seem to be a lot of overlay of the impact on the mental well-being of our society.
Yeah.
And so I talk a lot about, not about the future of work, but it's like, how do we look at the future of the whole person? And I think companies have to start doing that because you can't just look at the person at work. You need to look at how AI and tech is going to impact every aspect of their life to look at what the mental state's going to be. Huge. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we've been practicing recently is, instead of managing time, how do you manage energy? So philosophically, if you look at most businesses, you look at any professional services firm, they manage time and they charge time.
Yeah.
But actually, the thing they're selling is energy, right? Their customers want energy and outcomes. Whether it took me 10 minutes or 10 hours, I don't care. It's the outcome they want. So when we look at managing energy and we say to our teams and our staff around the world, we want you to bring your full self to work. One of the things we've realized is your full self might be at a different time than my full self.
Mm.
So how do we give you the flexibility? And flexibility, if you look at it in the last 20 years, has been company driven.
Mm.
I will allow you to be flexible for my benefit. What about if flexibility was for the employee? What if, as an employer, I just thought I borrowed you for 8 hours a day, that actually you belong to your family and your life, and I just borrowed you for 8 hours a day? I would treat those 8 hours very differently. And so how do I give you the tools, the technology, the practices to do the best work of your life when it's best for you? And that you is different for everyone. Working mums, it's different to dads, people with, you know, caring for elderly parents, people with disabilities and different needs, different systems, different rituals. And so what we're finding is, with distributed teams and remote teams, if we give them the right tools and the right discipline, and discipline is hugely important, otherwise they work 24/7 and burn out. If we give them those tools and discipline together, they will do the best work of their life. They will grow, they'll develop, they'll challenge. We get the right cognitive diversity. We get the right dissonance. We get the right respectful dissent. All those ingredients that look like a tax, but actually they're an investment.
I recently heard a statement from the guys. Are you familiar with Vervo?
No.
So Vuvo is like a recruitment disruptor, and basically what they do is they place people in 4 days rather than in 40 days. And what they do is it's all through simulations. So you don't actually apply for a job. They open source simulations for like UX and digital roles. You'd love this, yeah? And so it's all open source. So what happens is you apply for a job and your application is you doing these simulations. And so you prove your capability, right? Yeah. Before they even... And so anyway, it's great. They've got huge funding out of the US. It's a great concept and it removes unconscious bias.
Yes.
But one of the founders, Omar, was saying to me the other day, the way they operate their team, which I love, it's that they allow life to interrupt work rather than work interrupt life. And that's their whole attitude with a virtual team, which I love.
Yeah, well, philosophically, it's different because it's, again, that principle of I'm borrowing you.
Yeah.
So I have to show due respect for all the other commitments you have rather than thinking I own you. And the ownership comes from the old factory mentality and bureaucracy and management that I still think we teach in schools and educational.
Well, I need to see you to make sure you're working.
Yeah, and that whole view of the world was from a world that was very different, right? Where work was very manual, very labor. It was all about being efficient and all about being optimized. Mm-hmm. You had one brain, it was the foreman, and everyone else was hands. Where if you think about most organizations, certainly the ones I go and speak to and listen to, it's knowledge workers. Mm. Right, they're not actually using their hands, they're using their brains, their creativity, their curiosity. You can't tell me to be curious between 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. It's absurd
and exhausting.
So it's like, when can I do the best work of my life? And to do that, I need to know the purpose of the organization I'm working for. I need to know the outcomes. I need to know what I'm being held accountable for. And then I need people to get the fuck out of the way and leave me to it.
Mm.
And that style of leadership and trust and autonomy makes sense when you read it in a book. It's a lot harder to do in reality. So we're just trying to help people to try that out and see what happens.
So the last thing I want to talk about, because this is all about future-proofing, and I'm big on simple tactics that people can employ to start to shift themselves in terms of creating happier lives and enabling themselves to thrive in the future. Yeah. So little things, because I think everyone's so fearful and overwhelmed. Yeah. I'm generalizing, but a lot of people are overwhelmed and fearful. So I remember hearing you on a podcast not so long ago, and one of the tactics you had, which I absolutely love, was this concept of what have I loved?
The four L's.
Yeah, what have I longed for and what have I loathed? So can you explain this hack and how you use it to kind of stretch yourself for the future?
It's absolutely genius, and I wish I'd come up with it myself.
Oh, it's not yours.
Well, I read about it somewhere, and I was on a flight somewhere, and I read about it, and then I tried it, and then I realized when I reread the article, I was doing it wrong. But what I did worked for me. So the idea was it was about a team retrospective, and then I decided to do it on myself as a leader. So at the end of every quarter, I did the four L's. What did I love about the last quarter?
Yep.
What did I loathe? What did I long for? And what did I learn? And the great combination is the things that I learn, that's the story I should go and tell my peers. Because if I've learned something, I should share those lessons with other people. Because that's me empowering them to be a better version of themselves. And then if I share my lesson learned, they should share theirs, right? So it's kind of this mutual beneficial. The key bit, and this is the funnest part for me, that like this hallelujah moment, probably the last 9 or so months that I've been doing this, is the longed for and the loathed.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always have a long list of longed for, the things I wish I could do. And guess why I don't do them? Because I've not got the time.
So there's no fear in that list?
No, because I have to take out a loathed. So the rule set I give myself, the discipline is, I can only add in a longed for if I take out a loathed. Now, the first time I did this, it was incredibly painful because I realized that what I actually had been doing for about 20 years was adding in longed fors and never taking out the loathed. And I was doing lots of things in a really mediocre, average fashion. Now, I don't know about you, I never get out of bed dreaming of being mediocre.
Right.
I don't want to high five everyone going, that was really average. How cool was that? And so I was like, how can I claim to be a performer and someone who cares about performance and effective teams if I'm not being my best version of myself? So the first few times I did it, the things that I loathed were things that were broken.
Yep.
And the freedom it gave me, and this is where the fear comes in, when you remove those things, it gives you time back. And then you're like, what do I do with this time? And the thing is, the thing that you're going to try probably won't work.
And you know this, the more you
know
do
this, right?
The more you step into this own capital space, it's like, I know this shit's not going to work and I'm going to exhaust a lot of energy.
Yeah.
But there's a reason why you keep doing it, isn't
there? The few percent that do, when they land, you kind of go, wow, it has a profound impact. Now, the interesting thing is, now I've done this like 3 or 4 quarters in a row, my loathed now aren't things that are broken. They're just things that won't pay as big a dividend in the future as they've paid in the past. So now I'm stopping things. I'm not waiting for them to break to stop them. I'm seeing a trend of this thing slowing down, and I'm stopping it before it breaks. It's still valuable, but I'm using that time then to invest because now I still have mental energy. So I'm not fixing things. I'm trying new things that might just pay a different dividend. Now, if you think about it, financial companies have been doing this for 100 years. They have a spread portfolio, high risk, high return, low risk return, and you balance your portfolio.
And that's all you're doing.
That's all I'm doing.
So can you just give us one thing in closing, that's been a longed for that you've finally progressed?
So one of my longed fors was building relationships. There was a few sort of high profile Stanford lecturers, key authors that I wanted to meet and spend time with. And the problem with relationships is they take time, right? They are a proper investment.
Yes.
And so I was transactionally trying to do it, but I wasn't investing. And so what I did 2 quarters ago was I cancelled all my recurring meetings. That was my loathed, was all my meetings. So I cancelled every single meeting. And I only got people to add back in the ones that I was required for. The time that gave me back, I used to invest in relationships. That is me planting seeds that will not pay a dividend probably for 5, 10, 15 years. But if I don't plant seeds, I'll never get trees. So you got to do it.
Thank you for joining us today on the Human First podcast. If you loved your experience, please take a moment to leave a review on either iTunes or Stitcher and provide us with a rating. If you'd like to access the show notes or learn more about what we're up to in the context of humanizing the future, jump on over to humanfirstpodcast.com. See you next week.